You're listening to WFIU Bloomington, public radio for Indiana. Multicasting at 103.7 FM in Bloomington, broadcasting at 106.1 FM in Kokomo, and streaming online at WFIU.org.
Hey, thanks for spending time with me. Rusnowski here. This is Porchlight. Just this past week, I received a handwritten letter from a childhood friend. Nothing of interest worth sharing in it. My old pal was snowed in at his home in the foothills of the Berkshires. A thought occurred to him. He sat down at his dining room table and filled up two sides of paper with his thoughts in longhand. He wrote my name and mailing address on an envelope, sealed it, stamped it, probably left it in his letter box for the carrier to find the next day. Not simply a rare act by my friend. These days, it borders on the revolutionary. His cursive and his signature identify him in ways other than a number. His message came securely sealed in that envelope for my eyes only. Its journey to me covered an actual, not a virtual distance, so it took days, not moments. Added on to all of this is the extra time he willingly spent composing the letter. He didn't actually use stationery, but because his letter to me was tactile, like a book or a newspaper, there was more presence and pleasure in the act of reading what was written. Later this week, I will respond to my friend in kind, which means I too will be spending more time, more attention, and more upfront capital for my considered reply. Widely available technologies, of course, have offered me a far quicker choice, and along with it perhaps some vague gratification at the efficiency of it all. But let me repeat part of that first sentence. I received a handwritten letter from my childhood friend. Simply not enough efficiency being offered to match that type of gratification. Many years ago, on our daily walks to school, my friend and I probably passed a half dozen corner post boxes as we were being passed by hundreds of motor vehicles. Even back then, we were already taking way too much time.
And that time I went and said,
First up, Little Stevie Wonder, as he was initially billed, an exercise that his grandfather taught him when he was about 3. 2 coins, a dime and a nickel, tapped on a wooden kitchen table. Which one was it, Stevie? Then the Marvelettes. More cowbell? No. Louder hand claps. A small framed portrait, a lighted candle, corner shrine for one Mabel Payne. A friend recently shared a card he had received from an acquaintance who lives in Louisville. This gentleman had practiced calligraphy for many years. At first, he recreated documents, copied poetic sayings, or designed historical signage, all with Gothic lettering, a script dating back to medieval times. Recently, though, this gentleman has begun using his skills to write in elegant longhand, the Palmer method of penmanship, which up until 2010 was a national requirement for elementary school curriculums. Now, only 14 states require instruction in cursive for kindergarten through grade 5. Like violin, it's better to get those muscles stretched out early. As if handwriting didn't already involve considerable effort and concentration, the Palmer method introduced distinctive swirls, curls, and curves for every letter in the alphabet. Austin Palmer had created this style of longhand for business writing in 1894. By the early 20th century, it was being taught to children throughout the country. 3 parallel lines on a blackboard, made with a hand-guided contraption of wood, wire, and chalk. The thought was, if you could write smoothly, standing up, pinching a piece of chalk with the teacher and the whole class staring at you, you could do it anywhere. The goal was to be personally distinctive, yet completely legible. Achieving that seemingly impossible balance in the Terre Haute public school system for the year 1927 was the responsibility of Mabel P. Payne. Her title, Supervisor of Penmanship. Just the right slant and sweep to the capital G. Match the loops below and above the line for the lowercase f. As for the initial intention of the Palmer method, business correspondence, by 1927, most of Mabel's prized students were taking typing and stenography classes in high school. Legible handwriting was still essential for writing prescriptions, taking restaurant orders, and entering in ledgers, but increasingly it was the province of machines to create that perfect W. How well those lessons were learned is evidenced today mostly by women in their late 80s and 90s, that is, in addition to my friend's Louisville acquaintance. Like with the finest home cooking, there is a whisper of the individual in all that care and precision. Write me a letter. Oh, please do. I can see you in every word.
Oh, Lucy, I just got Fred's Christmas present, a Schaefer snorkel pen. You know, the one you fill without getting in the ink. Hmm? No, I mean the pen doesn't get in the ink. Only the little tube does. That's why they call it a snorkel pen. You just twist the little knob and a special filling tube comes out and it drinks up the ink. Not even Fred could get his hands messy with this pen. Hmm? No, he's got a ballpoint. What he needs is a good fountain pen for more important stuff, like signing leases. That's why I got him the Schaefer white dot pen. I got him a matching pencil, too. And they're packed in the cutest gift box you ever saw. Sure you can. I'll bring it right down. You know, I think Schaefer pens make the finest personal gift money can buy. So beautiful, so useful. Something to remember you by through the years. Won't you select your Schaefer gifts at your favorite jeweler, stationer, drug, or department store tomorrow?
Tom Zoss is a master of expression. Check out his curriculum vitae, excuse my Latin. Law degree, owned and published a small-town newspaper, excellent musician who once shared the stage with Glenn Gould, magician, puppeteer, fascination, his specialty. Yeah, I probably did forget something here, but you can blame his life for that.
People stopped using feathers to make quill pens. With the Industrial Revolution, they started making pen points. And you could buy a holder. And these were what we would today call a dip pen. Even though my grade school teacher, Olive Brandon, was a holdover, nobody else did it, I actually learned to write cursive with an inkwell in the desk with a dip pen, using the Palmer method, round, 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 and up and down, using a dip pen, and learn how to write without the point of the pen digging into the paper and going back to take a slurp of ink in the inkwell. And that's how we learned to write. And I was left-handed. Many lefties learned to write upside down because the table they were writing on was on the right. Now, bless her heart, my teacher made the custodian at Nooner School modify the desks for the left-handed people. We had desks with the arm on the left because she wanted us to be able to write right side up, not upside down. My wife and I are both left-handed. I'm a right side up lefty. She's an upside down lefty.
Whenever I talk to a person who has a great fondness for wristwatches or old cars, usually I find out it's something that they noticed when they were young. Was this the case with you and pens?
You bet. I started using fountain pen early on. Fountain pens were always interesting to me. Early pens that held their own ink, that you didn't have to dip every time, became fountain pens. 1890s to 1912, there were all these patent wars as different companies invented different mechanisms for getting the ink from the inside of the barrel down to the point. When I got into high school, I started adding a fountain pen. And I didn't have a lot of money, but I'd buy an Estabrook. Estabrooks, for years, were $2.95. If you were a salesperson, if you were a secretary, if you took dictation, you had to have a pen. It was your tool. Generally, people bought their own pens. It wasn't like throwaway ballpoints today where they were cheap and they're sold by the dozen and the office buys them and has them around. I once owned a set of Waterman pens for nurses. The bodies were white, but they had a cap on the end, so when you were looking in your pocket, you could see that one was black and one was red. And I was told that that was for day shift and night shift. When you made entries into the medical record at the foot of the bed, depending on what shift you were on, and of course, 12-hour shifts, two colors, red and black. And then I've seen a set of nurse pens that had green as well. And that was when the work rules changed and we went to 8-hour shifts. Fountain pens are still made today. My wife and I made an interesting trip to China a couple, 3 years ago. And China is sort of where we were in the 50s. Everybody uses a fountain pen. I have some interesting Chinese fountain pens that look like Parker 51s or a Schaefer white dot because they copy the designs. It might be a Mont Blanc today or a Pelican or one of the better brands, but the fact is it's still a symbol of learning. I suspect there are a lot of old pens laying around in professors' bottom desk drawers because it was a tool of the learned. But the point is that when you would go into the jewelry store to buy your fine pen, you would also select the point. You could have a very fine point, a very broad point. If you just use your pen mostly for signatures, you might get a stub point. So it'd have thins and thick line depending on how you did your signature. And the signature became a work of art.
And that leads us to something that's pretty essential in terms of our discussion. When you use a fountain pen to write a letter, there were so many components of the personal that went into that. Of course, the person receiving your letter wouldn't know what color your pen was, but the nib would affect what the cursive writing was, the color of the ink, and then what you just mentioned, in many ways an endangered practice now, and that is the ability to write in cursive and write artfully in cursive. I want to ask you about the more personal usage of pens in terms of writing letters and postcards. Could you talk a little bit about the power of cursive, the distinctiveness of a person's signature in their handwriting, and how that resonates and communicates with a person who's reading a letter that you've written?
Well, Tom, as you know, I'm a photographer. And especially in these days of digital photography, we all seem to take a whole lot more pictures than we do anything with those pictures, except maybe share them on Facebook or something like that occasionally. So I adopted printing my pictures that I like on note cards. And I'm a great one for writing notes, partly because I have these fountain pens. I'm always at the post office buying sheets of stamps, and the post office still has a special postcard stamp. And I pick up stacks of old postcards at garage sales, things like that. But the fact is, the impact of a note to somebody is way larger than it used to be. Like it's so much extra trouble? No. But it's so unusual these days. I regularly write notes to people thanking them for this favor or just mentioning it was nice to meet them, or I saw your name in the paper today and wanted to tell you that I was proud to know you, things like that. Oddly enough, with all the pens that we own and we've fixed up, I still have this blue Esterbrook, this $3.95 stupid pen with this point in it that makes my hand feel good and lets me control the line. I don't like red or green ink, and I'm tired of blue, so walnut brown comes across as sort of black, but it's not quite black. And that's me, and I'll write a note in that. And it seems to be appreciated more than if I just sent an email.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm gonna write words oh so sweet, they're gonna knock me off my feet. A lot of kisses on the bottom, I'll be glad I got them. I'm gonna smile and say, I hope you're feeling better. Enclose with love the way you do. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. Thank you. smile and say, I hope you're feeling better. And close with love the way you do. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
From my kid today, yeah.
Teddy bear, can't remember where. Daddy, is he there with you? In the letter he goes on to say, I'm so excited, Daddy dear, I found a little pup and washed and brushed him up. Tell me, can I keep him here?
What now?
Daddy, here's my puppy's picture. Don't you think he looks like me? We could be so happy only without you. It's lonely. That's the letter from my kid today. And gee, it makes me kind of blue. I know exactly how the kid is feeling now, 'cause I get mighty lonely too.
Fats Waller back there on vocals and piano. His first name? Oh, that's Triple Jeopardy, bottom row. But you already have a hint, don't you? Today, a steadily dwindling number of Tulsa, Oklahoma residents can still say, my folks first met at the Saturday night dances at Kane's Dance Academy with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. In the late 1930s, it was SRO, even with the crowd already standing. So Canes just put speakers outside, and the party would spill out onto North Main Street.
This week on Profiles, a conversation with poet Yaeli Camara about the role poetry can play in education, social justice, and as an antidote to truthiness.
I don't think that poetry is post-truth. I think poetry is a model for truth. There is a hunger for direction. I think poetry can provide that.
Join us for Profiles, Saturday at 5 on WFIU 2 and Sunday at 6 on WFIU.
Hey, nice to be with you. You're listening to Porchlight with Tom Rusnowski. Production support for this program comes from Smithville at smithville.com and from Gilbert Construction, remodeling homes since 1994.
Have you ever wondered what the future will look like?
Genomics will ultimately cure cancer.
I like to call this body 3.0.
You'll buy GPS dots in bulk.
Spare living parts fully integrate back into the body.
Generations after us say how ridiculous it was that humans were driving cars.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week as we look into the future on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at noon on WFIU.
is she? Have you seen her?
No, Mr. Richard, I can't find her. She checked out of the hotel, but this note came just after you left. That's the last call, Mr. Richard. Do you hear me? Come on, Mr. Richard, let's get out of here. Come on, Mr. Richard, come on.
First off, Richard Thompson, first album, first cut, post-divorce from Linda. Their last tour together swung through Bloomington in the early 80s. The music was very pretty. The rest of it, not so much. Then, on the heels of Rick and Sam leaving Paris in a hurry, Jimmy Rogers, the father of country music and stepfather of singer-songwriters everywhere. Hoagie Carmichael and Charlie Patton also lay claim. For this postcard home, the postmark reads San Francisco, California. Tom Zoss described a golden age of fountain pens that spanned the first half of the 20th century. Already in America by then, a golden age would be translated into advertising nationally in print. Parker, Schaefer, and more fountain pen ads were all over magazines like the Saturday Evening Post or Look. Full-page ads, too. Some of the most effective advertising back then never moved an inch. Sometime in the 1920s, a beautifully illustrated postcard of Union Square in San Francisco was created. I like to think the artist's view was from the St. Francis Hotel at Powell and Geary Streets. The St. Francis had opened in 1904. 9 years later, a North Wing was added. The North Wing offered apartments for the hotel's permanent guests. Nick, Nora, and Asta territory. Conversation and cocktails to close the evening with the sound of streetcars just below. Friday nights, our weekly ritual, just one cigarette lit up by something chrome-plated. Over a century later, the original structure for the St. Francis Hotel is still standing and incredibly still serving as a hotel, albeit the Westin St. Francis. No surprise is it that the permanent guests and their quietly elegant apartments have long since departed. I guess that softly lit billboard in the postcard advertising fountain pens is long gone too. Pleasant to realize that the billboard message was intended as a gentle reminder for out-of-town guests at the St. Francis to write something back home, like on a picture postcard or St. Francis Hotel stationery. And that writing would be done by a fountain pen you owned. No promotional ballpoints offered to guests just yet. As it turns out, the Moore Pen Company of Boston, Massachusetts, folded in 1956, just a half a dozen years beyond the golden age of fountain pens and Nick and Nora and the custom of that one cigarette on Fridays.
After 7 short weeks, our master master did speak, and now Roger Dale has gone. But I know that he's happy up there. I can vision each action and love. Friends, as you travel on, please remember this song, for it's written in our baby's book.
On a day like today, we pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand. How you laugh when I take our love letters from the sand. You made a vow that you would always be true, but somehow that vow meant my poor heart just aches with every wave that breaks over love letters in the sand. You made a vow that you would always
For over three decades, Ernest Tubb performed Our Baby's Book in high school gyms and small-town theaters all over Middle America, hundreds of dates a year. And at more than a few of these, couples would come backstage to introduce Ernest Tubb to their son, who they had named Roger Dale. In the initial recording of this song, Ernest Tubb actually yodeled. Two fewer tonsils and 25 more years apparently ended that. Then, did you ever get an earworm from matching up a distinctive vocal style with a particular song and you're not sure if the recording actually exists? Like, say, Marlene Dietrich covering Every Which Way But Loose. There was one right there. Yes, that was Patsy Cline with the Pat Boone Number One, Soaked in Strings, circa 1963.
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a-singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news.
the rockin' pneumonia. I need a shot of rhythm and blues. I caught the rolling off the writer sitting down at a rhythm review. A roll over Beethoven, they're rocking in 2x2. Well, if you feel it and like it, go get your lover, then reel and rock it. Roll it over, then move on up just a trifle further, then reel and rock with. Run another roll over Beethoven, dig these rhythm and blues. She wiggle like a glowworm, dance like a spinning top. She got a crazy partner, you ought to see him reel and rock. Long as she got a dime, the music won't never stop. A roll over Beethoven, 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 dig to the rhythm and blues.
Gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack. Bright and early next morning, he brought my letter back.
She wrote upon it, return to sender, address unknown, no such number, no such zone.
I dropped it in the mailbox as any special deed. Bright and early next morning, it came right back to me.
She wrote upon it, return to sender, address unknown, no such person, no such zone.
This time I'm gonna take it myself and put it right in her hand. And if it comes back the very next day, then I'll understand.
We're riding on it, return to sender, address unknown, no such number, no such zone.
Dear Mr. Editor, if you choose, please send me a copy of the Labor News. I've got a son in the infantry, and he'd be mighty glad to see that somebody somewhere now and then thinks about the lives of the mining men in Perry County. In Perry County and hereabouts, the miners simply had to go out. It was long hours and substandard pay. Then they took our contract away. And now 14 months is a mighty long time to face the goons on the picket line in Perry County. I'm 26 years a miner's wife. There's nothing harder than a miner's life. But there's no better man than a mining man. You couldn't find better in all this land. The deal they get is a rotten deal. Mountain greens and gravy meal in Perry County. We live in shacks that the rain comes in. while the operators live high as sin. Ride Cadillac cars and drink like a fool, while our kids lack clothes to go to school. Sheriff Combs, he has it fine. He runs the law and owns a mine in Perry County. I believe the truth will out someday, that we're fighting for jobs at decent pay. Why, after work, my man comes in with his wet clothes frozen to his skin, digging coal so the world can run and operators can have their fun in Perry County.
Gonna write a little letter, gonna mail it to my local DJ girlfriend, newspaper editor, whatever. Trace icons there, Chuck, Elvis, and Pete. The parting word to American poet Ezra Pound, born in the Idaho Territory, died in Venice, Italy. In between, he lived in London, Paris, a psychiatric hospital in Washington, D.C., and, of all places, Crawfordsville, Indiana. Ezra Pound expressed himself through writing, much of it done in longhand, contributed articles to a fascist publication in England, broadcast anti-Semitic diatribes for Mussolini's Rome radio, wrote an estimated 1,000 letters a year during the 1930s, one of which he signed Heil Hitler. Ezra Pound worked on his epic poem Cantos for 52 years, and it remained uncompleted at his death. Ezra Pound was perhaps best described by Kurt Vonnegut, even though Kurt was talking about one of his fictional characters, Billy Pilgrim. Over the course of his 87 years, Ezra Pound remained unstuck in time. When he bore witness to that experience, this is what he concluded, judge only by the results. Quote, "The art of letters will come to an end before AD 2000. I will serve as a curiosity." And so, next time. Thank you.
Bush and the Band.
Production support for Porch Light with Tom Rusnowski comes from Smithville. Fiber internet, streaming TV, home security and automation in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Gilbert Construction, specializing in restoring, remodeling, and revitalizing Bloomington area homes since 1994. More information about Gilbert Construction by calling 812-876-8110 or on the web at gilbertbuilt.us. Porchlight is engineered by our radio audio director, Mike Paskash. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Visit us at wfiu.org/porchlight.